Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program 396, titled Economics, Geopolitics, and Proxy War in the Middle East. This is being recorded on January 26th of the year 2003, and before I get into the broadcast, I will be talking about many complex things, and there will be many references to other books and other broadcasts that are available either in excerpt or in whole. Those are available on audio online from sister station WFMU. More recent programs, more recent For the Record programs, are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. And older For the Record programs are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org Dave Emery website and also to the Spitfire website, and specifically to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. There are also article-length, detailed, annotated descriptions of all of the more recent For the Record programs available on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com, and it is all available for free. Now, in this broadcast, we're going to be tackling some doings and some goings-on that have been taking place transatlantically, so to speak, and also vis-a-vis the increasingly depressing situation in the Middle East. I want to stress that the September 11th event and surrounding events are as complex as they are enormous and horrifying. One should be careful not to oversimplify. I'm going to introduce some concepts at the beginning of this broadcast that I will be referring to during the course of the subsequent exposition. Some of the concepts to keep in mind are, first of all, the theories of Karl von Clausewitz, the Prussian military theoretician, the economic theories for economic imperialism by Friedrich Liest. These are the foundation of the European Economic Union. Also, the concept of the virtual state. This is something that we spoke about in For the Record program number 393. It is a state without formal geographical boundaries. Al-Qaeda is such a state, and so, and more importantly, is the Underground Reich that I've spoken about so many times. And we're going to be dealing with the concept of the Underground Reich, and also with regard to the concept of the virtual state, the geopolitical theories of Karl von Haushofer that we have alluded to in the past. We will not be focusing as much on von Haushofer, on Karl Haushofer. So the three main concepts that I'm going to be introducing at the beginning and referring to at the end and throughout the broadcast, Karl von Clausewitz, Friedrich Liest, and the concept of the virtual state. We're going to begin by referencing a short section of a book that I've used many times in the past. That book was published in 1950 by Little Brown and Company. It was authored by James Stuart Martin, in charge of the decartelization program in Germany after the war, and in charge with attempting to break up the cartels that were so instrumental in helping to finance Hitler's war machine. That was James Stuart Martin, who was in charge of the economic warfare section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice. And in 1950, Little Brown published his wonderful book, All Honorable Men, about his experiences and the frustration of his and his colleagues' effort at breaking up the German cartels. Now, in explaining German power politics, James Stuart Martin makes reference to the very famous Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz, who in his tract on war enunciated a phrase that I've used many times. It is variously translated as war is the continuation of policy by other means, war is the continuation of politics by other means, or, and most relevantly in this context, war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means. And what's important to understand here is the German politico-economic thinking that sees wars and post-wars as a seamless continuity of policy. as we grope to understand the increasingly heated conflicts between the United States and Europe, again, something that should not be oversimplified, von Clausewitz is important to understand. James Stuart Martin wrote of von Clausewitz and his influence on German economic and political thinking as follows. The end of battle in 1945 had signaled the start of a new kind of war, a post-war. Germany's classical military theorist, von Clausewitz, is famous for having declared that, quote, war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means, unquote. In dealing with a Germany which had gone to school with von Clausewitz for generations, we knew that, conversely, a post-war is the continuation of war by other means. Since Bismarck, wars and post-wars have formed a continuous series, changing the quality of the events only slightly from year to year, with no such thing as a clear distinction between heat of battle and calm of peace. This post-war of the German occupation was different from the Cold War between the United States and Russia, which broke out at the same time. The latter complicated the diagnosis like a man getting typhoid fever and pneumonia at the same time. And as we've seen in past discussions, there was a deliberate confusion on the part of the Underground Reich between these two, and ultimately such elements as the Gehlen spy organization incorporating much of the cream of the SS and the Nazi establishment. It was incorporated into the U.S. intelligence system at the end of World War II, but as we've looked at in, among other shows, For the Record 180, General Gehlen was still clearing his plans not only with Karl von Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as the head of the German state, but also with Franz Halder, his chief of staff, indicating that the German chain of command was still in effect. Similarly, Islamo-fascist elements that we used during the closing phase of the Cold War and that were also used to help suppress left-leaning and sincerely democratic elements in the Middle East and elsewhere in the Muslim world, many of these Islamic fundamentalists now are turning on us as is the Underground Reich and the successors to Reinhard Gehlen. So bear in mind Karl von Clausewitz and his formulation that war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means, and the obvious political fact that the reverse is also true. In addition to von Clausewitz, remember Friedrich Liest. We've spoken about Liest in connection with our many shows about the European Monetary Union, the EMU, which has now reached realization with the creation of the euro. For the first time since the Roman Empire, all of the countries of continental Europe, all of the main countries, are using a common currency. This is a tremendously important phenomenon. We're going to talk about Friedrich Liest, who conceptualized the basis for the European Monetary Union in the 1840s. This book is called The Ideological Origins of Nazi Imperialism. It was authored by Woodruff D. Smith, a professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio. This book was published in soft cover by Oxford University Press, copyright 1986. And of Friedrich Liest's formulations, the foundation, by the way, for the now realized European Monetary Union, we read, many of the major elements of economic imperialism were enunciated in the 1840s by the ubiquitous Friedrich Liest, that's spelled L-I-S-T. Liest argued that overseas colonies were needed to supplement his favorite scheme for economic development, a Central European Economic Union. He foresaw an economic organization with an industrialized Germany at its center and a periphery of other Central and Eastern European states that would supply food and raw materials for German industry, and would purchase German industrial products. A semi-autarkic structure would thus be created. It would have the advantage of permitting control or even exclusion of British competition, thus allowing Central Europe to industrialize successfully in an orderly, planned manner. This Central European Economic Union formulated by Liszt was seen as a way of besting Britain, which was the great power of its time, and now is the basis for besting not only Britain but the United States. And one of the dynamics we're going to be looking at is the conflict between Germania, read the European Union and European Monetary Union, and Anglo-Saxonia, read the United States and Britain. Now, in addition to von Clausewitz, in addition to Friedrich Liszt, bear in mind the concept of the virtual state that we spoke about in For the Record 393. That was a term coined by University of Texas professor Philip Bobbitt and utilized in his book just published, The Shield of Achilles. A virtual state is a state with no formal geographical boundaries. Al-Qaeda is such a state. The Underground Reich, perhaps even more importantly, is such a state. And as I attempt to delineate and to elucidate some of the complex realities that are currently shaping the world, bear in mind the concept of the virtual state. One of the manifestations, and this may seem like a bit of a diversion under the circumstances, but one of the manifestations of the virtual state, and in this context, the Underground Reich, is the presence of a very real form of fascism within the Hindu nationalist movement. Now, this is not to say that all Hindu nationalists are fascists, but yet, in contemporary India, as yet a vital democracy, there is a very powerful Hindu nationalist element. And within that Hindu nationalism, there is an explicit fascist heritage to significant elements of it. I want to note that one of the spear carriers, in this case a legitimate term, for the fascist element within the Hindu nationalist movement was the assassin of Mahatma Gandhi. And again, this is by way of understanding the concept of the virtual state. The Underground Reich is such a virtual state, and Al-Qaeda and Islamofascism has become such a state. And yet we will find fascist influence within not only diverse but diametrically opposed ethnicities, such as, for example, the Islamofascist element present within Pakistan, and also the Hindu fascist element present within the Hindu nationalist movement in India. We have likewise seen in past broadcasts the fascist element within the Israeli right wing, and also the fascist heritage and affiliations of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Similarly, just as many American and European fascists are virulently opposed to Muslims and to immigrants from that part of the world, so too, in addition to the Islamofascist connections, those diametrically opposed European and American elements also have connections to this very important virtual state, the Underground Reich. Now, by way of illustrating the virtual state and how fascism operates within diverse and opposed ethnicities, and bearing in mind the fascist element in the Islamo-fascist movement, we're going to turn to the Searchlight. That is a British anti-fascist publication, not to be confused with the late Spotlight, an American fascist publication put out by the Liberty Lobby. This is from the Searchlight magazine of January of 2003, number 331. You can visit Searchlight's website at www.searchlightmagazine.com. Searchlight magazine is one word. This is an article called Hindu Fundamentalism, Why We Are Concerned. It was co-authored by Paul Crofts and Anjona Roy. And what we're going to hear about here is the RSS. That is a Hindu nationalist movement which was strongly influenced by fascism and which apparently has never repudiated its fascist element. One of its former members, Nathuram Godse, G-O-D-S-E, was the assassin of Mahatma Gandhi. Note that this Hindu nationalist movement is very powerful in India today and that it has a fascist element within it. And yet on the other side of the hotly contested and perhaps nuclear resolved border with Pakistan, there is the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamo-fascist element also connected to the virtual state of the Underground Reich and yet mortally opposed to its opposite number in India. This is the concept of the virtual state. It is complex, but it is essential that we understand this if the human race is to survive. Now, from Searchlight of January of 2003, Hindu Fundamentalism, Why We Are Concerned by Paul Crofts and Anjona Roy. Of the fascist element within the Hindu nationalist movement, we read, and the central element here is the RSS and the HSS. During the 1940s, the RSS's new leader, Madhav Golwalkar, following the death of Hedjawar, sympathized both with German Nazism and Italian fascism. In 1939, Golwalkar said, quote, "German race pride has now become the topic of the day. To keep up the purity of the race and its culture, Germany shocked the world by her purging the country of the Semitic races, the Jews. Race pride at its highest has been manifest here. Germany has shown how well-nigh impossible it is for races and cultures having differences going to the root to be assimilated into one united whole, a good lesson for us in Hindustan to learn and profit by," unquote. That from We Our Nationhood Defined, authored by Golwalkar in 1939. The authors continue. There has been no explicit and unconditional disavowal of Nazi-like doctrines by the RSS, HSS, or a repudiation of Golwalkar's ideas. Indeed, Golwalkar is held up as an example and spiritual leader for young RSS, HSS, Swayamsevaks, or members, and affectionately referred to as Guruji, unquote. Following Mahatma Gandhi's assassination by a former RSS member, Nathuram Godse, the RSS was banned by the Indian government from 1948 to 1949. After the ban was reversed, the RSS, while claiming to devote itself solely to cultural activities, created several offshoot organizations, including the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, VHP, or World Hindu Council, in 1964, the Jana Sangh Political Party in 1951, which was the precursor to the current Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and numerous other organizations. And I will apologize because I've almost certainly mispronounced some of those names. But note that on the Indian side of the standoff between India and Pakistan, the long-standing conflict, I should say, we have a fascist element within the Hindu nationalist movement. And in Pakistan, of course, we have, among other institutions, the Muslim Brotherhood, the parenthood of the parent organization of Al-Qaeda, and inextricably linked with the Third Reich and its post-war underground manifestation, the Underground Reich. By way of illustrating some of the connections of this virtual state, the Underground Reich, and its proxies, we're going to turn to a book we've used many times in the past. This, by the way, is the best book about September 11th and its attendant subjects, and it was written well before. This book was published in 1999 in French and in 2000 in English. It's called Dollars for Terror. It's authored by Richard LaBeviere, published in soft cover by Algora Press, copyright 2000 in English, and the translation was by Martin de Mail. What we're going to talk about here is the Dar al-Mal al-Islami, or DMI. That's one of the organizations that has helped to fund Al-Qaeda. In For the Record 392, we took a look at the intercession of George Bush's White House and Jeb Bush's gubernatorial regime, or a government in Florida, on behalf of a Saudi financier who was on the board of directors of Dar al-Mal al-Islami. He was under fire, politically speaking, for his involvement in some major projects adjacent to Disney World in Florida. And what's worth noting here is the connections between Bush, the Saudi elite, and the DMI, and in turn, as we're going to look at, the DMI's connections to the Bank al-Taqwa and the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamo-fascist organization connected to this virtual state, the Underground Reich. Turning to Dollars for Terror, in 1981, in the back rooms during the Islamic summit in Taif, Mohammed bin Faisal al-Saud, the brother of Prince Turki's brother, brought together major investors from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to create a private Islamic bank, Dar al-Mal al-Islami. DMI, the Islamic financial house, shares a headquarters in the Bahamas with the Bank of the Muslim Brothers. That, by the way, is al-Taqwa. Skipping down. Dar al-Mal al-Islami, or DMI, is an investment consortium made up of various economic and financial institutions like Faisal Finance, the Islamic Investment Company of the Gulf, etc. Based in Geneva, DMI has subsidiaries in 10 countries, Bahrain, Pakistan, Turkey, Denmark, Guinea, Senegal, Niger, and Luxembourg. The King Faisal Foundation of Riyadh figures among the principal shareholders. Created by the heirs to the late King of Arabia, this foundation is known for its many activities of religious proselytism, especially the financing of Quranic schools, Islamic art centers, and mosques. DMI is also one of the principal shareholders of Bank Al-Taqwa Limited, the Muslim Brothers of Egypt's bank, which plays also a central role in financing many Islamist organizations. So again, the concept of the underground Reich and the virtual state as manifested in both Islamofascism and the fascist element within the Hindu nationalist movement. Also, as we get into the discussion of the conflicts that are now becoming quite dramatic between France and Germany, or what Donald Rumsfeld called Old Europe, unquote, and the United States, bear in mind geopolitics, bear in mind von Clausewitz, least the concept of the virtual state, and also I'm going to toss in another element, and that is Sun Tzu and the Art of War. As I delineate the complex elements in this depressing and yet very important struggle, bear in mind that not everybody, not even necessarily most people, are conscious of all of the connections that are helping to pull their strings. In Sun Tzu's Art of War, he stresses, and indeed this applies to any form of contest, whether it's a chess game, a basketball game, a football game, in which one gets into one's opponent's mind or head, so to speak. Any contest involves deception. It also involves miscalculations, stupidity, greed, ignorance, selfishness. These are things that help to decide contests, including war. And stupidity, ignorance, selfishness, these are things that unfortunately are working against the United States right now. They are also not at all remote to the situation in Europe. Now, returning to the proxy war that I have alluded to between Germany and the European Union and the underground Reich in the United States, bearing in mind von Clausewitz, Liszt, the concept of the virtual state, and Sun Tzu, we're going to revisit a topic that we looked at in, for the record, 394 and 395, and that is the German surveillance of the cell in Hamburg that carried out the September 11th attacks. And as we've looked at in 394, August of 1998 is when this surveillance was in place. August of 1998 is when Germany and the EU began attacking the vital Menwith Hill listening station and the associated Echelon network, an act that I characterized in August of 98 as being an act of war, and in the information age, equivalent of the attack on Pearl Harbor, an analysis that I think resonates self-evidently in the wake of September 11th. Note also that Germany had the same capability, as reported in a European Parliament report on Echelon, and note that it was in August of 1998 that Osama bin Laden stopped using his satellite phone because it could be picked up by NSA. We're going to take a look at the Wall Street Journal of Friday, January 17th of 2003. Article Dateline Hamburg, Germany. It's by David Crawford and Ian Johnson. It's headlined, Pre-September 11th, Germany had Al-Qaeda cell in sights for years. In light of the fact that within a few days of September 11th, German intelligence had floated the deflecting story through the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, Germany's most prestigious daily, that the United States and Britain had forewarning of September 11th through the Echelon network, considering that Germany not only had that same capability, but that Germany also had the September 11th cell under physical surveillance and tapping their phones. This raises interesting questions, as I talked about in 331. For the record, 331, the legal concept of consciousness of guilt. Why were they pointing their fingers at the U.S. and Germany and also Israel because of the Echelon network when they not only had the same capability, but had been surveilling the members of that cell. One of the people they were keeping track of was Mohammed Zaidar Zammar, Z-A-M-M-A-R, a Syrian, skipping down in this article from the Wall Street Journal of January 17th. The investigators watched him closely, obtaining warrants to tap his phone and follow him, according to German intelligence documents. On August 29th, 1998, for example, investigators noted that Mr. Zamar attended a meeting on Bunteveite Street in Hamburg. Also present, Mr. Motasadeg and Saeed Bahaji, who fled Germany just before the September 11th attacks and remains at large. 2 months after that meeting, authorities had another clue that Mr. Zamar had links to dangerous people. According to German intelligence documents, his name, address, and two of his phone numbers were discovered in a raid by Italian police on an apartment used by members of Jihad Islami in Turin, Italy. The Italian police arrested three men and found an Uzi submachine gun, handguns, ammunition, wigs, false beards, and Mr. Zamar's contact information. By then, German investigators had begun another operation that would lead them to some of the Hamburg cell members. Acting on a U.S. warrant, police arrested a Sudanese businessman, Mamdou Mahmoud Salim. The charge was that he was one of Al-Qaeda's chief financiers. German police noted that Mr. Salim had regular ties to Germany. It was his fifth trip in 3 years. He regularly met with Mamoum Darkazanli, a Hamburg-based trader who ran an import-export company. German investigators were skeptical that Mr. Salim was much of a threat, but under pressure from the U.S., they extradited him to New York, according to investigators. And they put Mr. Darkazanli under investigation. They soon noticed that Mr. Darkazanli had regular contact with a fellow Syrian immigrant, Mr. Zamar. They also found that both men, as well as Messrs. Mossadegh and Bahaji, paid regular calls to a certain Hamburg apartment on Marienstrasse in Hamburg. Occupying that apartment was Mr. Atta, later the pilot of one of the planes that struck the World Trade Center, skipping down. On another occasion, a man named Marwan called Mr. Zamar, who urged him to visit him in Hamburg and as soon as possible. Marwan later moved back to Hamburg. Investigators have said that they didn't know who all of the men discussed in the phone calls were, but German residents must register with police where they live. A check of some of the addresses Mr. Zamar called could have revealed, for example, that Marwan, unquote, was Marwan El-Shahi, later a roommate of Mr. Atta and the pilot of the other plane that hit the World Trade Center. Skipping down yet again. The Central Intelligence Agency was aware of at least part of the German efforts, according to German investigators. They say that in December of 1999, the CIA assigned a case officer to the U.S. consulate in Hamburg. The agent tried to push his German counterparts to take stronger action against Mr. Darkazanli, according to a German intelligence officer. When the Germans replied that they hadn't been able to find any criminal activities, the agent suggested turning him into a double agent. Skipping down, according to German investigators, the CIA officer then turned to the Federal Office for Protection of the Constitution, which was conducting Operation Tenderness, the surveillance on Zamar. It couldn't be established whether he learned about the operation. The CIA had no comment. So again, the German behavior in the wake of September 11th is very, very interesting indeed, where they were saying, well, the U.S. and Britain, because of Echelon, knew in advance, Israel knew in advance, when it would certainly appear that with Germany not only having the same capability as Echelon, but having these people under surveillance, should certainly have known about the attack. Again, the concept of the underground Reich, the virtual state, and the conflicts I've spoken about. Many references have been made. All of the For the Record programs are available on Real Audio, courtesy of WFMU. Recent program streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only on Real Audio on a longer URL linked not only to the WFMU.org Dave Emery website, but to the For the Record section of the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. There will also be a detailed article-length description of For the Record program number 396 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. This has been Side 1 of For the Record Program 396, Economics, Geopolitics, and Proxy War in the Middle East, being recorded on January 26th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.